The court is ready to hear argument in 041003, Arturo Flores versus Millennium Interest.
May it please the court, Mr. David Hart will present argument to the appellants. Appellants will reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. David Karp here representing the appellants in this case, along with Mr. Harry Herzog. I'd like to speak today about 3 points. The first is the construction of the wording of the statute that we are here on, which is Section 5.077 of the Texas Property Code, and to show that really it's very clearly written and there's only one result that can be reached as far as its construction. The second issue I'd like to talk on is the goal of the appellees here is to neuter and do away with the statute. Because even if a certain construction is reached, that would say that only in the absence of a statement are the $250 a day liquidated damages actually applied, then that would still be excessive, unconstitutional, whatever. And to show that, really, in order for a party to get in trouble under this statute, they must be at fault. The third point that I'd like to discuss is the intent, or the lack of intent of the legislature, to have Chapter 41 of the Civil Practice and Remedy Code apply to Section 5.077 of the Property Code.
Why doesn't it apply?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, when the legislature evidenced its intent not to apply when they amended the property code in 2001. And in 2001, the amendments included Section 5.079 of the property code, and that was the statute that was addressed in the Brown versus Dela Cruz case, which this court recently handed down. In Section 5.079, the legislature took the word penalty and changed it to liquidated damages. This court, in its opinion, said that the legislature had changed not only the recipient of the liquidated damages or the assessment, but also the nature of it. And so if the legislature specifically changes penalty to liquidated damages, changing the nature of the recovery or the assessment, then I would contend that the intent of the legislature was certainly that it not be a penalty.
Well, liquidated damages sometimes are penalties. The difference might be penalties are always penalties. Liquidated damages may be a penalty and may not, right?
I would agree.
So it could be the legislature made a change, but that didn't necessarily make it not a penalty in all circumstances.
Well, I would agree, Your Honor. I think that the distinction is, though, we are looking for legislative intent. And when you have Chapter 41 that says it applies to penalties, and you have the legislature actually taking the word penalty out of the statute and replacing it with liquidated damages, then I think you have evidence of a legislative intent that Chapter 41 is not supposed to apply to Section 5.077. I think that the legislature could have done that in several ways. Yeah. The legislature could have left the word penalty in there, and maybe it clearly would have applied. The legislature could have said, it could have left the word penalty, but as it used to have the list of statutes to which Chapter 41 did not apply, it could have put in that list the Section 5.077.
So all the legislature would need to do to exempt, if they decided to give 30 times damages under the DTPA, is change the name from exemplary damages or extra damages to liquidated damages or actual damages. It would then be just a matter of what they called it. You could still get 30 times your actual damages and evade the language in 4102 that says, notwithstanding any provision to the contrary, this chapter applies. As long as you just call it something different, then you're out.
Well, I think that that is some evidence of legislative intent, that the legislature didn't intend for that apply, and in this particular situation.
Well, what does notwithstanding any provision to the contrary mean to you? That's pretty strong.
It means notwithstanding any provision to
the
contrary.
Pretty strong indication 4102 is supposed to apply to any action in which a claimant seeks damages.
But the legislature amended Section 5.077 in 2001 after the Chapter 41 was in place. And I think that there you've got further evidence of the intent. You know, Chapter 41's there. It's an easy thing to leave penalty, but by changing that wording to liquidated damages, I think you have a legislative intent, evidence of the legislative intent, that is not to apply.
But you don't think the legislature, you don't seriously think the legislature intended for someone to recover 10, 20, 30 times the value of their contract?
Well, Your Honor, I think that this statute
Do you think that? Is that what you think that the legislative intent was? If you read the language as you say it is, as plainly as you say that it is, the result is that somebody could recover those kinds of damages, liquidated damages. Now, do you think that's what the legislature intended with this provision?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. And if I may explain, this statute is so easy to comply with. It's like falling out of bed. Now,
so substantial compliance should be enough then. And if it's fairly easy to comply with the spirit of it, shouldn't that be enough? In other words, if you can tell from the statement, if you can make these calculations from what's in the statement itself, then why wouldn't that be enough if the purpose is ease of, if it's supposed to be so easy to comply with?
If you can make the calculations from what's in the statement itself, then I think you may have a very good argument that the statement includes that. But those are not the facts that we have. The only allegations are that if you go back and get the contract, and if you get prior year statements and bring in a bunch of documents, that you can sit down and figure all this out. And I don't think that's the intent of the statute.
Can you suggest a reason why the legislature would have thought that if a product manufacturer intentionally designed a defect that would seriously harm any user, punitive damages should be limited. But if a contractor for a deed of property should leave out one of these pieces of information, the damages are essentially unlimited.
Yes, Your Honor, and you know, if I may, again, it's so easy to comply with this statute.
Well, it's easy not to jaywalk, but we don't impose the death penalty for people who do.
I'm sorry, I didn't.
It's easy not to jaywalk, but we don't impose the death penalty on people who do.
Well, the legislature has a lot of discretion to address what they think needs to be addressed.
I'm just asking if you could suggest a reason, and the only one you can suggest is that it's easy.
Well, if I may finish, Your Honor, this is a great example because let's look at Millennium's conduct in this case. In 2001, they send out a statement that doesn't comply. Then they get a letter from the attorneys for my clients at the time, and it says, you hadn't complied. They don't send a supplemental statement. Then they send a statement for 2002, and it still doesn't comply. They come back with one additional piece of information. Now, if you're going to come back with one piece of additional information, why not give everything? Then, with the lawsuit's continuing, and this lawsuit's been, I don't know how long at this point before it finally gets corrected, but a matter of years. I mean, what is the legislature supposed to do to get compliance, to get this type of information to the people who are supposed to have it?
Well, I mean, the attempted compliance, in this case falling short, is no better than no compliance at all. I mean, they wouldn't have done any worse under these circumstances by just refusing to do anything, giving nothing. Same penalty.
That's right. Now, that's... Could the legislature have said if there's partial compliance, if you only get two out of the four, then you proportion the liquidated damages? Sure, they could have done that, but they didn't. And
I'm appreciative of the power of the second branch, or the first, perhaps the first branch. But what I'm still wondering, if we like to think that they're rational and that they make rational decisions and not just decisions that are within their power. And I was just wondering if you can suggest any reason other than ease of compliance why such potentially draconian penalties would be imposed for something as in need of correction as this, but it doesn't seem like it's any more need than a lot of other things.
Well, Your Honor, I have not read extensively through all the legislative history. I have read some of the law review articles that we've cited. The legislature held hearings. The legislature, I know, was concerned that we had the development of these colonias along the border communities, that there were a lot of abuses going on related to use of contract for deeds, that there were people who are unscrupulous sellers of land who were doing all kind of bad things. And all I can say is the legislature must have felt that this was a significant problem and needed to be addressed. And the statute used to say that the purchaser could take 15% off of his payment, and they came back and beefed that up. And so obviously they did not feel that that was getting the job done. And I think that this case is a prime example that it wasn't.
Mr. Carp, I understand the problem in the colonias and perhaps legislation for this. And I understand that the language in the statute has the word must. And if there is one part of that statute that is not complied with, then it's noncompliance. And I think that's probably what you have here. But I'm still wrestling with the issue that Justice Green raised, in that how could the legislature have intended for someone to collect more than the actual value of their property when perhaps there could be someone that understands this statute and wait 6 months, 12 months to file the lawsuit. And all that time, these $250 per day damages are accruing. And that's what you're going to have to answer from me.
Well, Your Honor, I think that, you know, again, the legislature made that decision.
Does it matter that the legislature perhaps is considering changing this statute during this session?
Would it matter in this case?
Yes.
I don't think that it would, Your Honor. I mean, the statute is what the statute is, and I think that the legislature was very clear when they passed the statute, as was noted in the opinion in Brown versus Dela Cruz, stated sometimes mistakes are made, but that doesn't give courts the ability to go in and rewrite the statute.
I'm not interested in rewriting any statute. I think we have great people over there that do that. I'm just trying to understand the legislative history.
Well, Your Honor, some of the legislative history that I've read and other similar statutes, they talk about what happens when the state mechanisms are not enforcing or not sufficient enough to enforce a certain statute the way that they would like. And so by giving private causes of action, you enlist the help of the citizenry to correct those types of abuses. And sometimes though that does lead to amounts recovered that may not be related specifically to actual damages. But as long as that is clearly set out, it's okay. And I think that's what happened here. And I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Unless the parties have agreed otherwise, we will hear next from the state of Texas as amicus curiae, and then the appellee, and then Acorn Land Corporation as amicus. But if you have a different agreement, that would satisfy the court as well. The court will hear from the state of Texas.
May it please the court, Mr. Bill Davis will present argument for the amicus curiae of the state of Texas.
May it please the court. The Texas legislature is both fully authorized and uniquely situated to enact effective consumer protection laws.
So could it just require forfeiture of your business if you didn't send one of these statements?
You're asking if the
you don't send a statement, you forfeit your business, whatever it is.
There are certainly some due process or some constitutional limits on what the
I can't tell what they are from your brief.
The due process cases are inapplicable. They speak to punitive damages that address the concerns about restricting unbridled jury discretion, unaccountability.
Due process is inapplicable. Excess fines is inapplicable. What's applicable? That's the part I don't understand.
I think neither is applicable in this case. I think
I know what is, though. What is to prevent the state from saying, if you don't send this statement, you forfeit your business? Or if anything?
There are no constitutional grounds on which this statute could be invalidated. That's the state's position.
Does the legislature mean liquidated damages anything other than what the courts have meant for 100 years by liquidated damages?
In response to your earlier question, I think that liquidated damages in 5.077 have a dual purpose. They partly compensate consumers, and they partly deter what the legislature identified as a significant problem throughout the state. And there are cases in which...
Where does that definition of liquidated damages come from? Our definition of liquidated damages is not that. They don't do partly one and partly the other. They either do one or the other. And if they do one, we uphold them. If they do the other, we strike them down.
The liquidated damages definitions tend to come from contract cases in which damages are difficult to quantify. And so they're set by the parties usually at the outset to be a reasonable forecast of just
So when the legislature used liquidated damages in the statute, they meant what we in Phillips versus Phillips and lots of cases for 100 years have meant by liquidated damages.
I believe that we would assume that to be true, that the legislature understood that definition.
So if this wouldn't pass muster under the common law, is the state, I'm just assuming, just assume that. I know you argue that it does. But if it didn't, what is to prevent the state from providing for such liquidated damages? Again, you say nothing.
I believe there's no constitutional grounds to prevent the state from passing legislation that is a valid part of a broader scheme to protect Texas consumers, as 5.077 is, and the surrounding provisions clearly reflect in the legislative history a need for the protections and the reasonableness of the damages.
You say there are no constitutional grounds for striking these damages in this statute. Are there constitutional limitations on the amount? Assume that provision is constitutional, is valid. Are there constitutional limits on the amount that are not stated in the provision?
The constitutional challenges in this case are under due process and the excessive fines clause of both constitutions. The excessive fines clause opinions cannot conceivably apply because the state, under the plain language of the provision, does not stand to collect the fee.
Why does that matter? I know you say all these cases historically view that as important, but I'm just wondering why it matters whether the state keeps the money if it takes it out of your pocket.
In looking at the excessive fines clause, I think that the U.S. Supreme Court has sought to determine what it was intended to prohibit. And principally, it's been applied in the criminal context, and the courts have simply limited it to that context.
And I can see that, but I wonder if anybody imagined at the time that these kinds of civil penalty type of statutes would come along. There's just nothing in the cases to indicate one way or the other.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So I'm wondering if the limitation to criminal matters and the government keeps the money are not just sort of accidents of history rather than principal distinctions.
I see my time has expired. May I answer?
Please.
The case law offers no support for a broadening along the lines that the court is suggesting. The case
except maybe for Danner.
I'm sorry?
Except maybe for Danner.
That is the only case that has been cited. Actually, in the excessive fines clause context, I believe it's the Galveston case that speaks to that. And Danaher speaks to the due process.
And you argue that they're old. And nobody has done much with them since. But that was true of delegation of legislative authority at one point until Boweevil came along. And I guess, do you find anything in the cases that you've cited, both from the federal courts and the U.S. Supreme Court and from state courts, that suggest that these limitations of criminal matter and government keeps the money are built into the clauses for a principled reason as opposed to that's just what they had before them at the time?
The United States Supreme Court opinions that we cite in our brief look to the history of the provision, and they clearly indicate that that was the intention of the drafters, that it apply in those contexts.
Thank you, counsel. The court will hear argument now from the appellee.
May it please the court, Mr. Miles Cohn will present argument for the appellee.
Your Honors, I'd like to begin by attempting to answer a difficult question that several of you asked and that I've been living with this case for the last couple of years, and that is, how could the legislature have ever intended a result as extreme, really bizarre, as the statute read the way the other side does would seem to lead in this case? It's a result that not only imposes this enormous penalty, completely out of proportion to the transaction itself, but also has obvious constitutional implications. And I don't mean to get into detail in the Constitution, but I will remind the Court that there are, both sides have done a lot of research on this case, and we've come up with just a few cases that deal with this kind of situation. The Danaher case, a U.S. Supreme Court case from 1916, the Hale case.
There are problems on your side, too, and the obvious one is, why would the legislature say, if you don't send them a statement at all, you owe them $1 bazillion. But if you send them a statement that doesn't say anything, you don't owe them anything.
I think, Your Honor, that Chapter 41 is partly the answer to that. And there are two parts to my argument, because in this case, my client did send a statement, and I believe that the statute can be read to not impose the penalty in that situation. We sent a statement, it's merely deficient. So we've made that argument. My honest belief is that the better way to deal with this case and the more logical way is through Chapter 41, and that's what I was getting to. I think this all fits together when you do that, because the legislature passed Chapter 41. In Section 41.02b, it says this provision applies to all damages in all other statutes.
What about the argument that this specific statute that we're here on today has been modified since Chapter 41?
It's been modified, but Chapter 41 still says it applies to all statutes, and I think that allows the legislature to set up whatever sort of scheme they want to in terms of damages, knowing that there's some reasonable cap on it if it's exemplary, that is, if it's beyond actual damages.
Is this just a felicitous turn of events, or is there any indication that you found in the history over there that this is actually what they were thinking in Chapter 41?
No, I think Chapter 41, this particular statute I'm not saying they were thinking about, but Chapter 41 actually had exceptions in it for a civil penalty, statutory damages, and they had all different names. Some were called penalties, some were called not liquidated damages, because these two statutes are somewhat unique, these two in the property code. But they were called all kinds of different things, and some of them weren't called anything. They're just statutes that said, if X happens, then you have to pay Y, without giving it a label. And when the legislature passed Chapter 41 originally, it had a laundry list of exceptions for various sorts of, whatever you want to call them, statutory damages, civil penalties, whatever. Then they took them out. Well, if they did not intend Chapter 41 to include these sorts of assessments, then why were there exceptions? And why are they taken out? So the structure of the statute, and I think, by the way, when they took the laundry list out, at the same time they added this broad 41.02b, which makes clear, I think, what may have already been the case, but that the limits in Chapter 41 apply to exemplary damages no matter what statute they're awarded under, unless the other statute has a lower limit. So the scheme sets up, and I think when you read it that way, it actually gives some logic to the legislature, if that can be said, that there is an umbrella, a limit that applies to all assessments of exemplary damages unless the other statute is lower.
And what is that limit?
Where is that statute?
What is the limit?
In 41.02, well, there are actually several provisions of Chapter 41 that would apply.
Right.
One that's applicable to this case is that if you don't have some actual damage, you cannot recover exemplary damages.
And so that sort of worries me here, because what actual damages, it would be an unusual case if you had actual damages, it seems to me, in this situation.
I could hypothesize that a buyer might say, I didn't have this information, therefore I could not refinance my loan, for example. And because I couldn't refinance it, I had a higher interest rate.
That wouldn't apply here, because as I understand it, the purpose of the statute is because, unfortunately, these people can't get typical types of loans, so that wouldn't apply here.
Well,
right?
This,
so there wouldn't be any financing, refinancing available.
Well, actually, there is financing for these types of lots. They're at a higher interest rate, and these contracts are at high interest rates. So there may be situations, especially as a buyer builds equity in his property and gets a better job. These are not, I don't call these poverty lots. These are $30,000 lots. People are putting up $50,000 homes on them. They're working class. And there are situations in which somebody might refinance something like that, and it does happen.
Do you agree that the statute, the word must in the statute, requires your client to comply with every single element of the statute, or is substantial compliance enough?
Well, must is directory, but the cases say you then have to ask, what does it mean if it's not there? And it probably gets into the question of what is a statement under the statute. And I don't know if that's what you're getting at, but if you look at the ABC, I'm not saying B doesn't exist. B does set up requirements. The question is, what happens if you don't meet one of them? Do the penalties in subsection C apply? And I believe that the logical reading of the statute, the way it was written, we didn't write it, but the way it was written, it says if you don't comply with A, if you don't provide a statement, then this penalty applies. It doesn't say if you don't comply with B. Now, I think the argument that the other side has raised is, well, where's the definition of statement if it isn't in B? What is a statement? And I think, well, first of all, I would agree with them on one count, which is that not every piece of paper that says statement is a statement. I'm not saying that if you sent a paper to your buyer that had the score of the Mets-Astros game, which was their example, that that's a statement. But if you look at the facts of this case, which is probably fairly typical, My client sent informative annual statements. The evidence is that they are typical in the mortgage servicing and the contract for deed servicing industry. And in fact, if you take a look at them, they're in the record, they're probably somewhat similar to the kind of mortgage statements that any of us would receive on a traditional mortgage. You know, they have an escrow statement. They include interest paid. They include some other data, including data not required by the statute.
I want to just return to Chapter 41
sure.
for just a second. Former Section C of the Section 5077 had a 15% deduction type of sanction.
Yeah.
Do you think that would have come under Chapter 41?
I think literally it probably would have. And one of the issues that I thought about as, you know, going through this is that there are penalties and sanctions that are not as extreme, yet they are still exemplary in the sense that they may go beyond actual damages. Now,
because it wouldn't make a lot of sense for them to come along and change from that regime to the $250 a day penalty and put the $250 under Chapter 41 when the other was not.
I think there may be two answers to that, Your Honor. The first is that in the concept of liquidated damages, which is, hasn't been used very much by the legislature, but I don't think there's anything wrong with the legislature. What if they had just said 15% and called that liquidated damages? The court might say, yes, that is a reasonable estimate of what actual damages would be, and therefore we're going to allow the legislature to do it, and that's not a form of exemplary damages. Liquidated damages, as used in the common law contract scheme, and the legislature did pick that term, has to be something that is a reasonable estimate of actual damages.
And what if it's not? Is that a constitutional violation? Or
I think potential.
We won't let parties do that, but how do we keep the state from doing it?
Well, number one, you have Chapter 41, and that's why, as I've said, I think all of this can fit together, because the legislature could say, well, let's have the penalty for X conduct be $1 million, and we're not going to worry too much about how extreme it is, because it is subject to 41, Chapter 41. You have to show some actual damages, and in Chapter 41, some of the provisions provide that there is some element of discretion. So even if you had a statute, except for DTPA, which is specifically omitted, you know, there's some specific exceptions. But for that, if a Texas statute said we have quintuple damages here for such and such a conduct, under Chapter 41, the judge would still have to look at the factors and decide whether that's fair. It might be fair in some cases to have damages that are three times or five times. Or
would you say fair?
Well, acceptable. I'm sorry. That may be the wrong term.
Acceptable doesn't help.
Well compliant with Chapter 41.
Are we talking about constitutional? Are we talking about constitutional? Or it's just Chapter 41.
Well, I'm talking primarily about Chapter 41 because it's my belief that if a statute, and including this one, Section 5.077, if Chapter 141 applies to it, then it would be constitutional because it would have a limit on it that brings it within constitutional bounds. If Chapter 41 doesn't apply, then you've got some more serious issues because the only cases in our legal history that address a statute like this say it's got a real problem.
Is there a problem other than the constitutional provisions that have been raised here? Is there a common law problem or not, do you think?
Well, I think you could get into the question. I'm not sure you'd call it a common law problem. It may be a statutory construction problem because the statute used the term liquidated damages. Liquidated damages is a common law term. It's a little odd to use it in a statute imposing what's obviously a harsh penalty. What do they mean? And on the one hand, if it had been the 15% level, I think we might have said, it might be reasonable to have said, well, this is a reasonable estimate of what actual damages might be, and therefore it's not exemplary, Chapter 41 doesn't apply. But when it gets to such a huge level as it does in this case, $250 a day forever, or 5.079, even up to $500 a day forever.
It's not forever, it's only until you correct the problem.
Correct, until the problem is corrected, whether or not it's brought to your attention, or I suppose... Yes, correct.
How does the state protect citizens, like the Flores is here and others similarly situated, if we apply Chapter 41, because under that scenario, it seems to me that the statute would never have any effect.
I believe the state could protect citizens by imposing a reasonable, constitutional, acceptable penalty. And I can assure the court that if the penalty were, you know, something that we could pay without going bankrupt, that my clients would take notice of the statute. And all would. And my clients are not, we take a little bit of offense at the notion that, you know, that the other side seems to throw us all together with people selling lots in colonials. Contracts for deed are often used in, as in this case, paved subdivisions with water and sewer. It's a way of selling property and keeping the price down. In this case, my clients had, as I mentioned earlier, an informative annual statement that's not unlike what any of us would receive on our mortgages.
But you would agree that the real impetus for the statute was the abuses in the colonies. But for that, the statute probably would not be.
I think that's the impetus for the statute as a whole. We have, you know, tried to go through the legislative history and can't find anything that explains why such a high penalty would be imposed.
Well, no,
for
I'm
this.
Just talking about the notion of a penalty and this information was clearly to rectify abuse within the colonial system.
Correct.
Of contracts for deed. I think we'd all acknowledge that. And you'd agree that your interpretation, although it makes sense, weaving it in with Chapter 41 to prevent abuses on that side, on the other side it would significantly take some teeth out of the statute as well, because rarely are you going to be able to show actual damages reasonably related to this amount. So either way, it's going to be a problem.
Well, I would say that as between the two extremes, if they are extremes, it's a lot more reasonable not to put out of business every seller of property under contracts for deed and let the legislature design something that makes a little more sense.
But you'd agree it would be extreme either way. I mean, your way does take a lot of the punch out of it.
It takes a punch out. You know, I wouldn't call it extreme because it's not putting anybody out of business and it's not putting anybody out of their houses. You know.
So if it were a 10-day fine, it'd be a different situation. If they came within compliance within 10 days and you had a smaller fine, you think it would be okay, even though that damage amount has no relation to any sort of actual damage?
Well, I think, as I mentioned before, you could have legitimate, and again, the legislature's never done this. This is a new thing, but could have legitimate liquidated damages, some amount of damages that is, you know, and if you're selling a $27,000 lot, how much can the liquidated damages be? It could be high enough to get the attention of the seller, but still within the realm of what actual damages could be, $2,000, $5,000, you know, something, but not, in this case, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I guess what I'm getting at is it really doesn't fit the liquidated damages common law construct, because in this situation, unless there's some refinancing attempt, you're not going to have any actual damages. And so there's never going to be a reasonable estimate of actual damages in reality. So any amount imposed under the statute is going to fall under Chapter 41.
Well, I don't know if I would agree to that. I think that there's a possibility of damages. Otherwise, why does it matter? I mean, if you're trying to protect against some abuse, that abuse must cause some damage to somebody or it's not an abuse. You know, people are entitled to get some annual report, some statement of their mortgage, their contract for deed. That's fair. And there's nothing wrong, you know, or improper or beyond constitutional limits of the legislature imposing some limits. And there's nothing wrong with imposing some civil penalties or remedy. But the question here is, what do you do with a remedy that goes way off the charts? Did somebody in the legislature really sit down and say, we should put out of business, because that's what this would do, out of business a seller that misses one line on one report 3 years ago?
So according to you, how does this work? We have a lawsuit with subdivision where one person didn't get a statement, one person didn't get a sewer, and one person didn't get water or electricity, and one person didn't get title or anything. The lot was sold to somebody else entirely. So they all file one suit, and then we ask the trial judge decide who's suing for liquidated damages penalty and who's suing for liquidated damages close estimate of actual damages?
I'm not sure I understand the question, because you're mixing all different types of claims under different provisions.
There's no other definition of liquidated damages other than the common law definition.
Correct.
And that makes a sharp distinction. Is this an estimate, fair estimate of actual damages, or is it not? It's a penalty,
correct,
or it's not.
And I think that's
in common law, that's a call for the trial judge.
Yes, it's a legal question.
Matter of law. So what you would say then is, applying that to this statute, the trial judge decides which of these claims are going to get $250 a day by making that same call and which are not.
Yes, although I would say in this case, when you're talking about annual reporting, there's probably, I can't think of any scenario in which $250 a day would be a reasonable estimate.
What if the plaintiffs decided to amend their petition and only ask for $5 a day, or $250 for the first 10 days?
Well, the trial court in this case found that if the liquidated damages did not apply, which he said it did not here, that they would be entitled to get actual damages for a violation of the statute. But in this case, there were no actual damages. They conceded they had no actual loss, and therefore he granted summary judgment. Now, if you did have a case under that interpretation, which is not really before the court, if you had that kind of a situation...
They said, I'm just worried about it. I'm worried, you know, how much I might accidentally pay the insurance twice, pay the taxes twice, so I want $5 a day.
Well, the statute doesn't have an either-or. It's $250 a day, and I think either Chapter 41 applies or it doesn't, or it's unconstitutional or it isn't. The one exception to that that the trial court found is that if they proved actual damages, I couldn't get my refinancing or I had some other problem.
What culpable mental state is required?
None in this statute.
And so you would say that under 41.03C, that since there's none in Chapter 5, there's none required under 41.03.
No, I think under Chapter 41, there may be a couple.
What is
state
it?
This statute does not require.
Now, what 41.03C says, you've got to have, sets out what the requirements are. But then it says, but if there's another specified culpable mental state, that would apply. So what's your position?
There is no other culpable mental state in this statute.
So you have to prove
therefore
fraud, malice, or gross
malice.
Negligence to recover.
Yeah, I think you'd have to prove malice.
That's your position.
Yep. That is my position. Now, and that's not true with respect to the actual damages that the court said were recoverable. They could still recover actual damages. But to recover this enormous penalty and put my client out of business, they'd have to show malice. They'd have to show that they had some actual damages. And as I said, I think when you use Chapter 41 in that way, it does tie all of this together and protects and helps us from having to reach a very difficult constitutional question.
When you look at the liquidated damages language and you apply the common law construct, do you do that on an individual basis? Does the legislature, when you decide whether it's an illegal penalty or a reasonable estimate of likely damages, do you do that? I think this follows up on Judge Brister's question, on a plaintiff-by-plaintiff analysis, or do you look at just fraud in the industry generally and it relates to that somehow?
Is it a constitutional question or anything?
No, I'm wondering, how do you determine whether it's a reasonable estimate? Do you do that on an individual plaintiff basis or contract for deeds
in the common law basis? Contract, the contract is for that situation, so it doesn't come up. I would think that if you're doing it for the legislature, you'd have to ask on the overall basis, not for each individual plaintiff, because this is a statute applicable to everybody. And if that's what they meant, if that's implicit in the term liquidated damages, that there's some assumption that it's a reasonable estimate. Now, I don't really think that's what's going on here. I think they just used the term as a way of creating a civil cause of action. You know, let's go to... really just a poorly drafted statute. They called it liquidated damages. They could have called it civil damages, but it's damages. And this court has said in a couple of cases that when, although old cases, but that's still the law, when a statute assesses damages and it's greater than actual damages, they are exemplary, and it uses that term. And I don't know that Chapter 41 could apply any more clear.
Further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will hear argument from Acorn Land Corporation as amicus curiae.
May it please the court, Ms. Grace Bellamy will present argument from amicus curiae.
May it please the court. We're here construing a statutory liquidated damages clause, and the court has keyed into the problematic nature of the statute, the fact that it's a liquidated damages statute. Liquidated damages, if reasonable, are enforced. If they're unreasonable, in a statutory context, then they're subject to the excessive fine clause.
Why, when the cases all seem to limit that to criminal penalties where the government keeps the fine?
In fact, the cases cited by the Attorney General, BFI, do not specifically limit the Eighth Amendment excessive fine clause to criminal cases. And following BFI, the Austin case does not specifically limit to criminal cases. In fact, the Austin case says the issue is not whether it's a criminal case or a civil case. The issue is it a penalty? Is it a punishment? If it's a punishment, then the excessive fine clause is applicable.
Do you know of other states which have construed their constitutions that way or not?
I do not.
No, one way or the other.
I do not know one way or the other if a state statute has. The Texas Constitution, however, or cases in Texas construing our state constitution excessive fines have, since 1980 and before in Pennington, said clearly the excessive fine clause in the Texas Constitution applies in civil matters. So this is a civil matter. This is a penalty. I think you have to get past that liquidated damages in this case is a penalty. Once that's established, then the excessive fines clause of the Texas Constitution clearly applies.
Would you say it's a penalty on its face, or do we apply the common law liquidated damages construct?
Your Honor, I would say facially under due process, it is. And in this case, it has to be as applied to Millennium.
But if a legislature is passing this statute because people are selling lots two and three times and selling lots with no sewer, water, or electricity, it doesn't look quite as facially invalid to say, we're going to penalize you $250 every day till you put the sewer in. Why is that clearly on the face of penalty?
Well, and that would be a circumstance probably that it might not be unconstitutional on its face under due process. However, what the legislature was doing, they were clearly addressing a problem. They were addressing the problem in Las Colonias. They were also addressing a problem in Tarrant County with a tornado, wherein landowners would take payments for insurance, and then where the buyer was the beneficiary on the insurance, obviously, and they did not pass on the insurance. That's insurance fraud. I mean, but there were clearly egregious problems that were being attempted to address, but what the legislature did was they went beyond the confines of their discretion. They went beyond constitutional confines, and they cast a wide net, and what they have done is brought in all the sellers who, in good faith, have been selling under contract for deed with not doing anything to harm their buyer.
How can we tell what's excessive?
You
don't think the usury penalties are excessive?
No, the legislature has said the usury penalties are not excessive.
Well, I know, but they don't think this. Maybe they don't think this is excessive. So, I mean, you're asking the judiciary to say this is excessive.
Well, the test in Texas would be, the primary consideration would be whether the penalty is fixed with reference to the object it is attempting to accomplish.
Well, it clearly is. Obviously they want you to send these statements. It may be that the petitioner is correct. It's not hard to do. And they anticipate that somebody who's fined $250 or $1,000 or $5,000 will correct the mistake and start doing right.
But often what the courts do in the U.S. Supreme Court in applying the excessive fine clause is done a comparative analysis, comparing the actual damages to the punitive damages. And when those punitive damages outrun the actual damages multiple times, then you can also move to the due process
arguments
in that regard.
They do in usury. You have to forfeit twice the principal.
But it's limited to twice the principal.
You do in antitrust cases. You have to pay treble damages.
And that is, I think therein you get into the notice issue of those statutes. The usury statutes, you're on notice, and even there is a bona fide error defense and an opportunity to cure under the usury statutes. Under the DTPA, for example, you have a notice provision. This statute does not have a notice provision such that one could comply and I'm sorry, my time's expired.
Complete your thought.
One could comply and not even know that there was a violation being alleged. It seems that when the legislature imposed a $250 a day, that they thought that the violator would realize they were in the wrong. So therefore, they had $250 a day penalty for the length of time it was going to take them to cure the problem.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Harry Herzog will present rebuttal for the appellants.
There are three issues I'd like to cover. They're all questions that have already been asked by this court. Justices Medina, O'Neill, and Owen have already asked questions about Chapter 41 that highlight the fact that they don't want you to construe Chapter 41. They want you to judicially veto Section 5.077 by applying Chapter 41 in a way that it can never, ever allow 5.077 of the Property Code to be enforced. And all you need to unravel that argument is to look at the definitions in Chapter 41. If money is awarded for compensatory purposes, it is defined as not an exemplary damage. Now, Justice Brister asked some hypotheticals.
This is not for compensatory purposes, is it?
Well, I absolutely believe that Section 5.077 is designed to compensate the victims who do not receive
for
the annual statements. Well, one example that was given.
I mean, that's all Judge Hughes said. Oh, you prove actual damages, but you don't want to prove actual damages.
Well, Judge Hughes said we could plead and prove actual damages as he threw the case out of court when we didn't have a chance to do it.
I mean, surely you want the $250 whether you can prove the actual damages or not.
One hypothetical was given, which is more than hypothetical, I believe, in this case, and that had to do with refinancing. If Mr. Flores had been able to prove actual damages of $10,000 because he couldn't refinance to get a lower interest rate, and if they had cured the deficiencies in their statement in a week, do you think they would have paid him the $10,000, or do you think they wanted to cap it at the liquidated damages that would have been lower? Now, the case argued before our case, Justice Heck, that was a $50,000 fine imposed on a lawyer. Did they have to plead and prove malice or fraud? Did they have to have unanimous jury findings to do that? If you're on the trial bench and you find the lawyer did something wrong and you hit him with a $1,000 fine, do you have to have malice or fraud? According to Mr. Cohn's construction of Chapter 41, yes. He's found a trump card in Chapter 41 that he thinks busts every penalty across the state of Texas. It's a misconstruing of the statute.
But you'd acknowledge there are problems with this statute.
Oh.
I mean, it was not intended to be a gotcha that a year later someone who hasn't sent everything out is going to go out of business. How would you rectify the abuse on that end? I think both parties have acknowledged if you read it the way each of you want, it's either going to be bad legislation that will never rectify what it was intended to rectify or bad legislation that's going to put a lot of good people out of business.
Let me answer that question three ways. First, if I'd been in the legislature with my good friend Mr. Cohn, we might have both voted against this statute. We might have given an implied private right of action. We might have imposed a sliding scale of liabilities. You get 1 out of 4, 2 out of 4, 3 out of 4, 4 out of 4 wrong. We might have imposed a sliding scale of damages and said, this is how much the plaintiff can recover. These are the elements of damage. We might have put in a cap.
You might have said, if you don't send the statement, you forfeit your business. You might have been so perturbed at what's happening to the Colonius, which is a bad thing, you could have said, if you don't send it, you forfeit your business. Could the legislature do that?
I don't think the legislature could. I know that Miles and I would not have.
But why can't they?
Well, I think that would have some constitutional problems.
Excess fines or due process or both?
I think due process.
Well, isn't that what we have here, perhaps, Senate?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you, Justice.
Couldn't that be what we have here if this statute is upheld and there'd be an excessive fine to this company and perhaps put them out of business?
The Fifth Circuit might have that problem. This court does not have that problem because this court doesn't have jurisdiction to answer a question that the Fifth Circuit expressly didn't send.
The Fifth Circuit always puts that language in there.
Yes, sir, but they can't rewrite the Texas Constitution.
No, but they always put in there, we disclaim any intention or desire that the Supreme Court of Texas can find it to reply to the precise form or scope of the questions.
Yes, sir.
So they may not be trying to adjust the Constitution. They might be saying, if we don't quite ask the question right, please answer the one we meant to ask.
I think that's an excellent way to phrase it, and I certainly think this court can, in construing Section 5.077 in statutory language or in answering questions on Chapter 41, you can say, well, you missed a year in your question. I think they gave you as broad a range as they can give you, and I'm happy to have this court run within that ball field. But they cannot change the constitutional provision that was passed that allows you to answer a certified question and no more. And they cannot change this court's opinions that say we cannot answer a question raised by the parties that was not raised by the certifying court.
But we can, and one of our principles of construction is to look at, construe a statute constitutionally if we can. So we can look at and say, without deciding, there may be constitutional problems were we to construe it a particular way.
Well, Mr. Cohn gave you that eloquent mechanism. The problem is, after he gave you that, he then says, any way that you construe this statute that awards liquidated damages of $250 a day is unconstitutional. So it's not helping you to construe the statute to analyze that. He's just trying to repeal the statute by arguing it's
unconstitutional. What's the answer to Judge O'Neill's question?
I'm trying to remember. Please forgive me.
On the two, the polar opposites.
Rectify the abuse on the other side.
Okay. Well, the first thing the legislature could do is pass a new statute that says...
That wouldn't help us here.
It won't help here.
What do we do with the one we've got? Is there a way to not...
I think you're in the same position. Here's the best, most direct answer I can give to that question. I think you're in the exact same position here that you are with Regulation Z and Truth in Lending, that you are with hypotheticals already brought up of antitrust and usury, that you are with a constitutional provision that says if you do a home equity loan and don't give the borrower a copy of the document, you've given away the money. He doesn't have to repay it. It's harsh. It's a harsh legislative remedy for a big problem.
All of those examples have limits.
That's true.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. That concludes the argument and all arguments for today, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All right. Oui, oui, oui. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.